In presenting this introductory talk on Dog Zen, I am acutely aware that the potential listeners will fall into two categories. In the first place, students of Nemata, the staff of student teachers, and in the second place, anyone else who comes along, either as a registered visitor of Nemata or anyone who may come across this page on the internet. After all, the course pages on Nemata are publicly open to anyone who cares to investigate them. Likewise, I'm aware that in the first category, there may also be, or there certainly are, two categories. Among the staff and visitors at Nemata, there are some who have some knowledge of Buddhism. Perhaps that may be a superficial or passing knowledge, curiosity. Others may have been involved with Buddhism in one way or another, may have studied it, may have encountered people who follow Buddhism. And secondly, there will be those who have no background in the subject whatsoever, and perhaps little or no interest as well. Well, as I do consider myself these days somewhat of a comedian, and as far as Dog Zen is concerned, I am certainly putting out a kind of comedy, a form of comedy. I'm mindful of the situation that every stand-up comedian faces, which is the diversity of people in the audience. So, in the situation of a stand-up comedian, he never knows who is out there exactly, and who is going to laugh, who is going to remain stone-faced, who is going to be offended, who is going to walk out, and so forth. So the situation facing a stand-up comedian is a good analogy for the one I'm facing right now. What I'd like to do in this introduction, what I'd like to accomplish, comes down to, let's say, three things. First, I'd like to express my gratitude towards certain people whom I have encountered in the genre of Buddhism. Second, I'd like to say right up front and in simple and explicit terms why I consider myself qualified to say anything about Buddhism at all. And thirdly, I'd just like to set the course for Dog Zen by outlining loosely some of my principal objectives in launching this little comedic project. Why do I call it a comedic project? Well, I do intend to make fun of Buddhism. I do intend to ridicule it. And in some respects, that ridicule may come across as nasty and disrespectful, offensive. And in other respects, it may prove to be entertaining, and who knows, even enlightening. In addition to that objective, making fun of Buddhism in all its shades and schools, there is a dual purpose, which is to make enlightenment, fun. So as I'll explain in the third set of considerations I'm presenting here, in Dogsen, enlightenment is considered to be an event in progress. And my intention is to do my level best to see that that event is fun. So with that little introduction, let me proceed to the gratitude part. Gratitude. Do I feel gratitude toward Buddhism? Well, Buddhism is just a system, it's a philosophy. And considered on those grounds, merely on those terms, I would say, yeah, you bet I do. I first encountered Buddhism in Japan when I was 19 years old through the writings of Alan Watts, The Spirit of Zen. And from that moment at the age of 19, through a good 50 or more years of my life, I have been quite deeply and consistently involved in the study of Buddhism, and I have benefited enormously from that study. And I have drawn both personal and transpersonal insight and direction from what I have picked up through my studies. Now, bear in mind that I have never practiced Buddhism as such. I've never meditated. I've never gone on a retreat. I've never taken instruction from a Buddhist teacher. I've never involved myself in any Buddhist groups. All that being so, I am more than happy to state at the outset that if anyone considers me to be unqualified to say anything about Buddhism, I would not argue that point. I have no argument. I am certain that serious students of Buddhism, many of them, would hold the position that book learning is no way to approach Buddhism. It has to be experiential. You have to dive in to the pool and swim around a few laps. You can't simply read about it and learn anything. And I totally accept that objection. And anyone who wants to dismiss me out of hand on the basis of that objection is welcome to do so. But remember, I said something about gratitude. I want to make it clear that I am grateful for what I have learned by my studies in Buddhism, by an immersion of over 50 years of my life. Even though what I learned was not necessarily what Buddhism intended to teach me, nevertheless, I learned a lot from delving into what Buddhism is supposed to teach. I delved into the message, and I delved into the method, although I never actually practiced any particular formula of method, as do those who become adherents and practitioners of Buddhism. But there's another aspect to my experience of Buddhism. It took the form of particular encounters. Now, these encounters were random, you could say, and they were isolated and brief. They were brief encounters with certain people who are involved deeply in Buddhism. And so I did meet with some flesh and blood practitioners, both teachers and students and scholars. And I'd like to express my thanks to those individuals for the opportunity I had to meet them. In every case, The opportunity proved to be extremely fruitful to me, even though it was only a brief encounter and was, in most cases, not even repeated a second time. So at the exact moment when I release Dog Zen upon the world, I want everyone to know who I met, and I want those that I met to know that my gratitude toward them is sterling and pure and solid. No matter what I say about Buddhism, does not alter the fact that I had these encounters, and from them my knowledge of Buddhism developed in such a way that I am able to talk about it as I can today. At the top of the list, my gratitude goes out to the man who was considered to be the supreme master of the Nyingma sect of Tibetan Buddhism, Dudrum Rinpoche. So I had an audience with Dudrum Rinpoche in Santa Fe in the early 1980s, not too long before he died. And from the moment of that audience, I was not fully aware of what I received, but over time I became aware of it. And I can assure you that I consider the result of that meeting to be a rich endowment to my life and to my mission, if you will, as a teacher. Secondly, there is Tokul Tundub, who at the time I met him was associated with the Marion Foundation in Marion, Massachusetts. He lived at that time in Cambridge, and I had the occasion to visit him one afternoon after having met him at a conference sponsored by the Marion Foundation, the Marion Institute, as it's now called. At that talk, I presented the subject of Gnosticism, and I shared the platform with Gnostic scholar Elaine Pagels. So I'm grateful to the Marian people for allowing me and inviting me to present that conference, to co-host. And there I met Tokul Tundub, who encouraged me to write a book on Gnosticism, which I did, not in his image. And he kindly invited me to his home, and I accepted that invitation. At his home, I had a critical conversation with him about the subject of termas and tertons. Terma is a word in the Tibetan language which means a treasure, by some accounts an earth treasure, ter-ma, a treasure of Mother Earth, you could say. And the tertan is the particular individual who has the special destiny, the rare destiny, of discovering termas. So my conversation with Tokul Tundub, for which I will be forever grateful, concerned that topic. I also want to extend my gratitude to Michael Talbot, who is a close collaborator of Tokul Tundub and a translator of Tibetan texts, whom I met at Marion, due to the fact that the venue, an establishment building for the Marian Foundation at that time also housed the offices of the Buddhayana Foundation, headed by Harold Talbot, who received me warmly and genially. Now, it so happens that the Buddhayana Foundation was established in order to support the work of Thukul Tuntup. The individual who set up the Buddhayana Foundation was Michael Baldwin, one of the three Baldwin brothers, the other two being Ian and Philip, were close associates and colleagues of mine over a number of years. But Michael Baldwin is an individual who's been deeply involved in Buddhism for a good part of his life, and who acted as the sponsor and benefactor of the Buddhayana Foundation. So through Thukul Tuntup, I met a living representative, an advanced scholar, although he claimed when I met him that afternoon not to be a tulku, but to be merely a scholar and a historian of Buddhism. Well, nevertheless, there he was, and there he is today, I believe, as an outstanding representative of Buddhism in the world, a living exemplar of the message and mission of the Buddha, and standing front and center with him is Michael Baldwin, a longtime or lifetime student and devotee of the teachings of Buddhism. It was my great, great fortune to meet these people. And although I only saw Thukul Tuntup once in a private interview, I have been often in the circle of his close associates at Marian. Moving on from there, I come to another individual who is, I think without question, a great heretic of Buddhism in our time, renegade, a sort of madman by his own assertion, the proponent of crazy wisdom, and that would be Chogyam Trungpa. Now, Trungpa was indeed a tulku. I think he was the 10th or 11th Trungpa in a succession of the Kagyu lineage. And he was also, I come to learn recently, a Tertön who discovered certain termas. Now, I never had an audience or a person-to-person contact with Trungpa, but I saw him once in L.A., where he spoke somewhere, over there by Beverly Hills, I think, in an enormous hall, attended by about 600 people. I don't know exactly how to say what Chogyam Trungpa means to me, but I can say that the feeling I have toward him is love. I do love this man, and I love him a lot. Now, of course, I didn't meet him as I met Dzogchen Rinpoche, or Thukul Tuntup, now called Thukul Tuntup Rinpoche, I believe. But I was in his presence once. And some days, most days lately, since I've gotten on this Buddhist riff, I have to say that I feel like I'm in his presence a lot. In fact, not too long ago, I had a lucid dream about him. So anyway, I was always enormously attracted to his message, and I feel more than ever now sympathetic with his style and I consider him to be a total anomaly in the realm of Buddhism, going all the way back to Siddhartha. So my gratitude goes out to Chogyam Trungpa in a quite special way. Now, I'm not going to run down the names of Buddhist scholars whom I've read and studied. There's a large number of them, and I'm grateful as well to what I've learned from them and to the tremendous work that they've done, not only in preserving certain Sanskrit and Tibetan materials, translating those materials is not no easy job, but also in their accounts of the historical aspects of Buddhism, which are, of course, extremely complicated. But I will mention just one, a special instance, and that would be Janet Gyatso. She's the author of a book called Apparitions of the Self, The Secret Autobiographics of a Tibetan Visionary. And this is a book about a celebrated Nyingma Turtan called Yigme Lingpa, whose initials happen to be JL, but of course that's simply a comedic allusion. I've benefited hugely from other Tibetan scholars, but I just want to add a nod of gratitude here toward Janet Gyatso, because her extraordinary book really, really helped me to realize the conditions that pertain, both the difficulties and the delights, the challenges and torments that pertain to a Turtan due to the very great fact that I assign myself that title. It's one of my outstanding pretenses. So there you go. That's where it stands regarding the real life encounters with Buddhism, and that's really all there is to it. So you can see that it's almost nothing at all. It doesn't amount to much, does it? It amounts to a totality of a few hours of my entire life. So, moving on to the second element of this introduction, my qualifications. Given that I've merely acquired my knowledge of Buddhism through books, coming ahead from Alan Watts at the age of 19, well, how on earth can I possibly have the arrogance to presume that I could pronounce anything or make any judgment or assessment of Buddhism if I'm not coming from an experiential position? If I'm not coming out of the experience of Buddhism, how can I possibly critique it? How can I make fun of it and make enlightenment into fun? Well, I feel absolutely no need to excuse myself. I feel no need to legitimate myself. Absolutely not. But I can answer that obvious concern in a direct way, like this. There's a term that comes out of the 60s. It's associated with psychedelic movement and the use of shamanic plants, LSD, mescaline, and so forth. It's a term that's current and legitimate, widely applied in the field of noetics and cognitive psychology. And that term is altered states. Now, it's odd, or you might find it odd, I do find it a little odd, that in all my studies and discussions of Buddhism with people, I've had friends, other friends who were self-designated Buddhists. It's rather odd that in all those discussions and in all the expositions of Buddhism that I've ever encountered, I don't think I have seen one Buddhist scholar use the term altered states. It's a term that has largely been confined, as I said, to the genre of anthropology, cultural anthropology, and in particular, that aspect of anthropology and the cognitive sciences, which concerns itself with shamanism. Shamans who ingest psychoactive plants such as datura or mushrooms, such as Psilocybe cubensis, experience altered states. Well, so do Buddhist masters, lamas, rinpoches, tulkus, siddhas, vajradharas, vidyadharas. All of these types of mystics and practitioners of Buddhism in all its various forms, the nine yanas, Dzogchen, Chan, and Zen, well, all of them experience altered states. As a matter of fact, if you take a few steps back and you assess the view, the path, and the goal, that's the operative trope, the three-part trope, the view of the practice of Buddhism, to attain enlightenment, the path or process, and the goal. If you take a few steps back and assess all that, you find that in fact, what is the goal? Well, in fact, the goal is to experience altered states. You could argue that enlightenment itself is an altered state. But more particularly, and I invite you to pay heed closely to what I'm going to say now. More particularly, those Buddhist masters such as Longchenpa, or masters living today, do claim to have achieved altered states without using that exact expression. As a matter of fact, what's the point of all their initiations, meditations, exercises, stages of practice? What's the point of all that? What's the objective of all that? Well, certainly the objective, you could say quite simply and straightforwardly, is enlightenment. But hold on a minute. Those who achieve those objectives, that is to say, the high adepts that I'm going to call them, as I'm going to call them. The high adepts, for instance, of Ati Yoga, the highest level of Dzogchen, and so forth and so on, do experience visionary states, visionary events. They see lights. They see enormous, boundless fields of the fractal display of Buddha worlds in all directions, in all 10 directions. They do see these things. And as a matter of fact, it is by achieving these altered states that they qualify for being accomplished masters. And they all share a knowledge, like an in-group knowledge among each other, of what it is like to have these experiences. Now, in my critique, if you want to call it that, of Buddhism, I point out, I will point out, and I shall indeed point out, that there is something rather disingenuous about the way in which the accomplished masters speak of the altered states that are the, let's say, natural, although I would never apply that word to Buddhism, the natural outcome of their practices. So far, I have only found one example of a Buddhist / Dzogchen / Bonpo master who actually says what it is like to experience these altered states. That's what I mean by disingenuous. Who is not disingenuous? As far as I know, that would be Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, author of a book entitled Wonders of the Natural Mind. Now, I've read a ton of books on Buddhism, and over again, they describe, the authors of these books, and sometimes the books are presenting original writings, you know, sutras, scriptures, not just the words of scholars, or not even the testimony of living Buddhists today, but the original scriptures upon which the whole system is based. In all of that material, you will find, I believe, as I did, that there is a strange way of disclosing the result of their experience. At least I find it strange. I find it dishonest and disingenuous. In other words, the typical scholar or the typical scripture, even of Longchenpa, will describe these altered states or allude to these altered states, which are visionary states. Things are seen, things are heard, lights are seen. And yet, the description or disclosure of the states is not given in a first-person manner, such as, I did this practice and then I experienced this. Just as someone would talk to you face-to-face, telling you, you know, I sailed around the world solo on a boat, and I experienced this when I was going through the Straits of Magellan. I experienced this, a direct first-person testimony. But you find that coming from Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche. And I'm grateful to him and I have exceptional respect for him in having revealed himself in that manner, because other Buddhist masters, if you get my point, only speak of these experiences of altered states in the abstract, or they distance themselves in the way that they describe them. All right, so what am I getting at here? Why am I elaborating on this point? Well, it gets back to the second consideration I'm presenting in this introduction, namely, my qualifications for saying anything about Buddhism at all. Well, I certainly can't claim to be qualified due to having reached some profound level of the experience of Rigpa comparable to these adepts. As far as I know, I haven't reached that level. As far as I know, mainly from what I get from these honest first-person descriptions in the wonders of the natural mind, as far as I know, I haven't had any particular experiences like that. And I certainly haven't had them consistently and profoundly in such a manner that I can retain the state of attention that is required to have such experiences or to produce such visions. So I can't claim to have direct knowledge and experience of the altered states described by the great Buddhist adepts. However, I have experienced some altered states of my own, some altered states of a different kind. And I do consider myself to be rather qualified in that area. So what do I refer? Well, I refer to the altered states that arise in the practice of Planetary Tantra, of Gayan Tantra, as I call it, which is just a name for practical animism, experimental mysticism, a certain form of shamanism. I practice a certain form of shamanism derived from the ancient mysteries of the Mediterranean or Near East and the European cultures. So I am a consistent heir to the traditions of those cultures and to the shamanism that is specific to the mysteries and to those who are called Gnostics. So the Telestic method, as I call it, was the primary method of the ancient mysteries. And I've practiced that method, and not just on my own. And I've confirmed the results of that method by undergoing altered states. And I can assure you that there is a difference. There is a great difference between the kind of altered states that I have experienced in shamanic trance, telestic trance, and those which are recorded in the annals of Buddhism. And so my position is rather unique, isn't it? I don't come to the floor as an insider and an adept of Buddhism who can talk the talk and walk the talk of those altered states. But I come with a record of experience in altered states, nonetheless. And so I'm saying at the outset, that's what qualifies me, above and beyond all else, above and beyond mere intellectualism. That's what qualifies me to take on Buddhism. In other words, just in case you didn't get the point so far, I am directly pointing to the fact that there exists, living today, a method and a body of practices that comprise mystic illumination, noetic awakening, and a kind of enlightenment, this enlightenment. All that exists today as a body of experience that can stand against the body of experience upon which Buddhism is founded. And if you happen to be so fortunate as to have the opportunity to investigate and compare these two bodies of experience, and if you have the disposition and the capacity to look into it with discernment and sobriety, well, then you have a great good fortune at hand. That opportunity to compare is incomparable. That opportunity to put side by side the claims of ultimate realization of altered states in Buddhism with another set of claims is a wonderful, fortunate, and transformative option in this world today. And I invite you to consider that option. So finally, coming to the third feature of this little introduction, I said that I would just kind of point the way that Dog Zen goes. I've titled this introduction, The Woke and the Woof. So you all know what the woke is, don't you? The woke is the Buddha, the woke, enlightened one. The woke is Sambodhi, which is the Sanskrit word for enlightenment. Sambodhi, the woke, those who are woke, which is unfortunately a current and highly corrupted meme in social discourse. But there you have it anyway. It's an ancient meme. You all know what the woke is. Even if you have no knowledge of Buddhism at all, the very least that you know is that it has something to do with a state of enlightenment. Which means to be awakened, to be woke. But what about the woof? What's the woof? Well, the woof comes with dog Zen. And the woof comes in the form of a little mantra. And the mantra comes from your generic dog in the form of the bow wow. Bow wow. That's what a dog says. Bow wow. That's how you say it in English. You know, meow. Cat says meow. And the dog says bow wow. And that's the woof of dog Zen. But you have to tweak it a little because it's all a big joke anyway. It's all meant to be fun. You have to tweak the bow wow a little to see the message in it, to see the instruction. There's a profound instruction in the bark of a dog, the soft bark of dog Zen. What's the little twist? Well, consider this. Where there is reverence, even a dog's tooth shines. Now, I object really strongly to the reverence and the bowing and scraping, the schmoozing and pandering that goes to any Buddhist master from the Dalai Lama all the way down the line. Khandro La, you name it. I strongly object to these insipid and obsequious expressions of reverence. The woof of dog Zen is a trope that takes you to something you can really feel reverent about. It takes you to the moment when you bow to the wow. Bow to the wow. That's an instruction of dog Zen. Do not bow to any human master. Do not bow to any adept, any siddha, vidyadhara. Call them what you wish. Do not bow to anyone of any degree of attainment. There is no degree of attainment greater than your own. And the only thing I can tell you about my enlightenment is, it's yours. But if you want to bow, if you want to show reverence, if you want to feel reverence, and it is, I believe, innate to the human animal, the desire, the craving, the profound need to feel awe and reverence. If you want to enter that experience, then bow to the wow. And what is the wow? The wow is the ultimate awesome beauty of the earth. In the altered states that I have experienced, when you stand in naked awareness, eyes open, sober, but ecstatic, not hallucinating, not succumbing to any vision or any special effects whatsoever. When you stand in the presence of the awesome beauty of the earth, that's wow. And bow to the wow. Give reverence where it belongs, to that which is superhuman, which is your source, which is the matrix of mystery and the matrix of life. In Dog Zen, as in Planetary Tantra, of which it is nothing but a comedic interlude, in Dog Zen, the ultimate object, here's a cheap word, of reverence is just that. The wow, the sensational, sublime presence of the living earth, your divine mother. And that is such. So I say to you, in concluding, that Planetary Tantra is nothing but a remake and an upscaling of the oldest religion on earth, the oldest spiritual view on earth, which comprises the view, the path, Lam, and the goal. And that is animism. Animism. Dog Zen, as signaled by the icon of the dog, the animal, belongs to the animism of Planetary Tantra. And it has in it, includes, Dog Zen includes, this element of animism in an extremely clever way. Fucking Tibetan A. You see, animism satisfies the devotional need of the human animal. And it does so, mind you, in a manner that cannot even be approached by the noetical complexity of Buddhism. As a matter of fact, the ritual encumbrances of Buddhism make it impossible to reach the glorious simplicity of this animistic connection between you, a creature that lives, and that which is the source of your life. Of course, Planetary Tantra is the path to that source. So what I can say finally, in conclusion, offering just a nudge, a slight nudge in the direction of the domain of Dog Zen, is this: the first heresy of Dog Zen is this: the mind is not intelligent. Intelligence is alive. The mind, which is the primary topic as well as the tool of enlightenment, in Buddhist terms, is not alive. Your mind is not alive. Mind, in Dog Zen, is simply the non-living, insensate tool of intelligence, which is utterly, utterly alive. That heresy, That proposition is the spearhead of everything that I have to say and can say and shall say to my dying breath. In the exercise of this little comedic interlude called Dog Zen. And if it happens, and who knows, it may just happen, that the words in this introduction come to the ears of some Buddhists in the world, then I will sign off this talk with a message directed to them specifically. It's not a message in my own words. It's simply a line from a poem by the great romantic German poet Hölderlin. And it goes like this. Whoever has thought most deeply loves what is most alive.